I will work day in and day out. Wake up and smell the coffee.
We want to return to the European Union.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by John Cruddas, the Labour MP for Dagenham and Raynham, and the author of a fantastic new book released recently, A Century of Labour. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Will, good to be with you. I think we had a chat a few years ago, didn't we?
We did, yeah. About the last book, yeah. So it's great to have you back on. And the first question I'd like to ask is, apart from the fact that it is 100 years since the first Labour government was formed, what other reasons did you decide to want to write the book?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, because I was approached to see if I would write a history of the Labour Party for the 100th year centenary of the first Labour government. And the first question I asked was, why? Because, you know, there's masses of Labour history out there. I mean, you go into any bookstore, you go on Amazon, you go to any Guardian bookshop, there's reams of it. So the first question is, why would you want to add to it? Is there anything more to be said, really? And that was, I toyed with that for ages. And in the end, partly because I then took a load of time to read and reread masses of Labour history, and maybe we'll come back to it later, but my sense was that there was a gap in terms of some of the ideas that have informed the history of socialism and the history of the Labour Party. There's an awful lot of, I mean, the most usual way of going through Labour history is through biography. So, you know, and there's some fantastic biographies of Keir Hardie, Ransom MacDonald, George Lansbury, you know, Cameron Hadley, Tony Blair. You know, you go through the whole ritual. But that tends to my mind, overemphasize the role of the individuals in history, you know, the great men and women. Or you can look at specific Labour governments. So there's a really good couple of books out there on the first Labour government. And you can look at the personalities, you can look at the factions, you can look, but it seemed to me there was very little done about the ideas that have informed Labour history. So I thought there might be a different way of approaching it, which I've tried to do in the book. So that was the first question of why would you do it? And then the second question is, you know, how could you do that? You know, and that proved, again, quite a challenging question. So those two basic questions, you're absolutely right to start this conversation about why would you do it over and above the question that there's a date there that signifies 100 years. Why would you do it? Because there's so much out there. Is there anything more to say? And I think there might be. I mean, it's not for me to judge, really, because my view is there is a different way of navigating this extraordinary, turbulent history. And that's what I've tried to do in the book. But that was the one I toyed around with for quite a while, because writing a single volume history of the Labour Party is a really big thing to do. I mean, you know, and I thought, well, it's a great thing to do as a Labour MP who's approaching the end of his parliamentary career. It's a great sort of indulgence to do your own sort of history of it. But at the same time, it's quite a challenge in terms of the reasons to do it, you know? So it was something I toyed around with quite a while, and I was resistant for quite a while to doing it. But in the end, I jumped in with both feet, so to speak, and come out the other end. Because I mean, the other thing is, because it was tied to a specific date, it was sort of non-negotiable. Yeah. You can say, can have a few more months to finish it, because, you know, there's a bit of a cliff edge there, yeah, in terms of the actual final date, which is the 22nd of January 1924, which is the date of the first Labour government. So it was quite daunting and quite intimidating, actually. But in the end, I got it done. So
yeah. You got there in the end.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find fascinating that you address at the beginning of the book, three particular questions: the origin question, the death question, and the purpose question. Could you just expand a bit on what you mean by those
three questions? Yeah, well, they're sort of shorthand, really, those three questions to navigate a lot of Labour history. Because if you look at it, it seems to me these three questions jump out at you. How do you try and put together all this Labour history and begin to get to some of the questions that sit behind a lot of the contributions? And if you look at Labour history, up until the 1950s, despite some dreadful election results like in 1931, what jumps out at you is this question, which I call the origins question. There was a sort of inevitability attached to the role of Labour. It was like socialism was going to happen. History was going to unfold. And so the first question, really, origins question, is was it inevitable? Was it inevitable that a party of Labour would arise in the first quarter of the last century and overtake the Liberals? And a lot of the Labour Party did think it was inevitable. It was inspired by certain Darwinian thoughts, certain Marxist determinism, certain religious views, utopianism, which assumed that Labour, and a view of social and scientific progress attached to the Labour Party, which assumed that it was inevitably going to succeed. That sort of changed somewhat in the early 50s, given changes to the class composition of the country, post-war affluence, mass consumption, liberation. And then the origins question and the inevitability of socialism inverted into a question of could Labour ever win again? Was the party over? And this, I call this the death question. It informed a lot of 1950s revisionism. Later, it was famously captured by Eric Hobsbawm when he asked, is the forward march of Labour halted? It informed a lot of the modernisers in the 1980s, New Labour, and all of the, there's a consistent theme there that the party's over, Labour's on the wrong side of history. So the origin question and then the death question, that's the two. And then the third one, which seems to me are far more important, because both of them assume an inevitability to Labour's rise and fall. There's a sort of deterministic view of history unfolding and the laws of history and all that, which I'm always resistant to that sort of deterministic approach. And there is a different way of approaching it, which is, what is the purpose of Labour? Rather than looking at an essential purpose attached to a specific rise and fall of a class, why not see it as a way of, it's always been a Labour has always been an alliance of different organisations, factions, traditions, and look at it as a way, a vehicle that where these different traditions are bent through, and can you tell a different story, not just based on a rise and fall, but its relative success in weaving together these different elements that have always been within it and indispensable to the Labour tradition. And can you tell a story about Labour history through these three, what I call traditions of justice, and the relative success of Labour putting together or not? And that is very different to the factional view which dominates Labour history, especially within, about some definitive truth to what Labour's about in terms of the purpose question. I think the purpose question is much more open-ended and fluid, and there was no definitive creed or definition of what Labour is. I see it more as a way of combining different traditions within an overall political project. And so I call that the purpose question, which is, has remained unresolved despite the views of various Labour Party factions.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know in the book you don't particularly want to concentrate on individuals, but one individual I do have to ask about is someone who was at the very start of the book, Ramsay MacDonald. And his place in the history of the Labour Party has obviously changed over subsequent decades. Do you think we're at a point now in 2024, 100 years after he first became Prime Minister, that we can have a reasonable view of MacDonald and a proper analysis of both his merits and some of the negatives that many of his detractors apply to him without falling into the trap of just labelling him as a quote-unquote traitor?
Right, exactly. And that, I mean, the more you investigate this, it seems to me, whilst Keir Hardie has been sanctified by Labour, Ramsay MacDonald is often perceived as a sellout to the cause, the first prime minister who succumbed to the bankers in 1931 and the establishment. And is, you know, from the left, he's viewed as a traitor. From the right, he's viewed as an inadequate or incompetent or something like that. But if he, my view has always been, if Ramsay MacDonald had died in the 1920s, he would be revered and celebrated on a par with Hardie. Because he was an extraordinary true Labour pioneer. He was a brilliant orator, a fantastic organiser, tactician, a major intellectual force. He'd written 12 books through the 1920s. You know, you can say he sort of helped build Labour and helped virtually destroy it as well. I mean, we lost 225 seats in 1931. But lest we forget, he was the first secretary of the Labour Representation Committee, a position he held for 12 years. He was a brilliant tactician who oversaw secret negotiations with the Liberals, which helped ensure Labour's 29-seat breakthrough in 1906. He actually lost the leadership or the chairmanship of the Parliamentary Party on his principal position against the First World War, which meant he lost his seat as well as his chairmanship of the party. And he suffered great personal hostility and animus because of that. And arguably, in 1922, he successfully got back in as an MP and then as a leader. But and he became arguably the most significant politician of the 1920s. So his sort of nuance and complexity has largely been removed. And should we not forget, in the calamitous events of 1931, 10 others of his colleagues in cabinet accepted his proposals in terms of managing the budget. You know, the cabinet was split. An awful lot of people who were the most virulently hostile to Macdonald in the years later supported him and his proposals in cabinet for the 56 million budget cuts in 1931. So, you know, I think you can say he made calamitous decisions, but for honourable reasons. You know, and I think David Marquardt wrote a brilliant book about Ramsay Macdonald, which I think reclaimed his contribution. But I think we still need to go further, because part of the problem with Labour history is we're attached to this mythology and this romanticism of history, and we lose context and nuance, never more so than with Macdonald. I mean, moreover, the politics of austerity hasn't just bedeviled that government, it's bedeviled every single Labour government throughout history. So, you know, there was a tragic quality to 1931, and it was a tragic quality to the rest of Macdonald's life, actually. It's a really sad story for such an extraordinary individual. So part of me wants to say, and probably the greatest mistake he made was, which is a really what-if sort of counter in Labour history, if you'd argue, what happened if in 1931 Ramsay Macdonald had accepted the advice of John Maynard Keynes and built a British New Deal and resisted austerity and reflated the economy and the international currency regime? This is before FDR had built the New Deal in the early to mid-30s, the first and second New Deals in America. That could have been an extraordinary legacy. But he resisted that, partly because, as I mentioned earlier, this notion of the inevitability of socialism or gradualism and socialism meant that Labour was less equipped on the policy side of things as it should have been in those early periods. And arguably it rose too quickly and was too successful in coming to power in the two minority governments in the 30s. So I think there's a story to be told about trying to import a bit more nuance and context and acknowledgement of the extraordinary contributions that Macdonald gave to the Labour movement for decades before the calamitous events of 1931.
Absolutely. And I think it's something really important that you touch upon there is the mythology that is often associated around certain figures in the Labour Party. Keir Hardie perhaps is the most mythologised figure in the Labour Party. I've spoken to Chris Clark, who's written about this extensively, in terms of the myths that we have often in the Labour Party and the broader left. Do you think that it's something that the Labour Party specifically suffers more from than other political parties? Or do you think across politics there's a tendency to mythologise certain figures and create myths that appeal to this faction or the other?
It's quite interesting because I think you could say Thatcher is mythologised in the Conservative Party in very different ways to someone like for her successes. And Blair is mythologized in Labour circles. And in my view about just going to Thatcher and Blair as examples of this, those people who are left at the end of the period of these extraordinary political figures, their career, they tend to be the most hardline supporters of them, who were there at the death, right, of their when the tragedy played out. when they were got rid of in different ways. And they sort of tend to dominate the interpretation of the contribution and have lost some of the context and the depth of their political contributions earlier in their careers. The consequence of which they tend to be simplified. The contribution seems to be sort of truncated and it loses its depth, especially the case with Blair. I tried in the book to rethink Blair legacy, because we tend to look at it like like Ransom and Donald, in many view Blair as a traitor, which is, in both instances, it seems to me quite ridiculous. They were trying to grapple with all sorts of different challenges. The early Blair period, I think, was a really creative period where they welded together these three traditions of justice in a brilliant political project that captivated many, many millions of people and built three big majorities. I mean, I think it changed. The real question about New Labour is how it changed rather than what it was. You can't just simplify it to one thing, because it was in power and evolved or reduced into something that was very different to what it started from. So, but the way these myths are made, it also means that Labour is ill-equipped to own its own history, really, for good or bad. And it creates a simplistic history where the different factions demarcate Labour history in ways that lose its essence as a coalition. That's always my view, and it loses the plural quality necessary for reconciliation and to rebuild. So this myth-making, this romanticism, this attachment to certain forms of history is very damaging within Labour, and I think it partly accounts for the turbulence within Labour history where we've had this dreadful defeats, because often when we lose, we're out of power for a very long time. When we lost in 1931, we're out of power for 14 years. When we lost in 1951, we're out of power for 13 years. When we lost in 79, we're out for 18 years. Since the loss in 2010, we've been out of power for 14 years and counting. Hopefully that will change within a few months, but intermittent victories are often followed by very long periods in opposition. And I think that's partly because of the factionalism and the myth-making and the political backfilling that goes with this desire to reinterpret Labour history, depending on which faction you belong to. And that is to the detriment of Labour as a electoral, agile political force.
And you touch upon the different types of justices that you reference there, and you reference throughout the book. Could you just explain what you mean by these particular different types of justices?
Well, what I try to do in the book is go back to political philosophy, really, and trying to have a new sort of portal or entry point into Labour history. Because I said it's usually by faction or biography or whatever. And if you look at political philosophy, if you look at works like people like Michael Sandel and his conception of justice and the different kinds, you tend to alight on three different approaches to justice. If you talk to a lot of Labour Party members, they'll tell you, well, we believe in a just society, which is all well and good, but that can mean very different things to different people. So it seems to me to try and unpack that notion of justice is a different way to navigate Labour history. And if you look at it, it seems to me there's three. And these are basically competing views about how society should be organised. The first one seeks to maximise questions of human welfare, primarily utility. They tend to be distributional in terms of material resources. It's often associated with Fabianism, but it's also parts of Labourism and characterised by this, and welfare economics, whereby it's about the distribution, who gets what. And that has been the dominant approach both on the left and the right of the Labour Party throughout the years. And so it's a question of scale rather than qualitative difference between these factions on this time. They share more than they actually disagree with, I would like it. So that's one, maximising questions of human welfare. Material justice, distributional justice, let's call it that. The second one goes back to the Magna Carta or the Civil War, which is about maximising questions of liberty and freedom for people. It has a rich, proud history in terms of figures like John Lilburn or the Levellers or the Diggers or Chartism. I separate different types to do with legal equality or human rights or political or constitutional reform, but they all share this theme around maximizing human liberty and freedom, especially in the aftermath of the Second World War, tyranny and fascism. This came to the fore in terms of international conceptions of human rights and very much informed Attlee's approach to what the New Deal was about, his New Deal in terms of building a welfare state, economic and social rights for all citizens. So that's the second bit. Informed 5 decades of legislation from Roy Jenkins onwards about codifying or legislating issues of equality, racial, sexual, gender equality, culminating in the Equalities Act of 2010. And the third one, which is often described as ethical socialism, which is really about maximizing questions of human virtue, has a real long history within Labour and the prehistory of Labour. Before the Labour Party was formed in the 1880s, 1890s, the dominant approach was what used to be described as the religion of socialism. This notion of how do you create a life well lived? What is it to be, to live a good life and contest the human degradations intrinsic to capitalism? It's informed questions of working class self-actualization. It's informed questions of community, rebuilding civic virtue, citizenship itself. In terms of the economic sphere, it focuses on the guild socialist tradition of contesting the ownership of production and economic democracy, industrial democracy, control of the means by which capitalist commodities are produced. So it's not just distributional, or it's not just about human liberty, it's about human actualization, what it is to be human in and of itself. And those three traditions are all indispensable to Labour history, but they're very different. And, it, you know, you've got the Fabian tradition or the liberal progressive tradition or the ethical traditions. How these are weaved together, I think, is a different way of telling the story of Labour history.
And, I mean, how do you think, thinking of the first Labour majority government, the 1945 government, the Attlee government, how do you think that government was able to weave those traditions together?
Right. Well, that, I have a very different approach to Attlee. Specifically Attlee himself, but also that government, but then a lot of the history, which sees it as quite a orthodox utilitarian approach in terms of the approach to nationalising 20% of the British economy, quite centralising. Whereas I think, rather than just being about that form of distributional justice, it was a much broader coalition. Firstly, because of Attlee's own story, with the continuity Attlee brought with the history of ethical socialism and the Labour pioneers of Ramsay MacDonald, Keir Hardie, George Lansbury. I mean, the continuity formed, you know, Clement Attlee in 1908 helped form the Stepney branch of the ILP. He was a real radical, genuine radical socialist. He wasn't this little mouse that Dalton once described, or this manager that a lot of people think as this technocrat. You know, Maggie was a much deeper figure anchored within the ethical socialism of and the idealism of the Edwardian period. And he hid a lot of it within this orthodoxy, what I call it, rib cage of tradition. But he provided continuity with the pioneers of Labour and that ethical socialist tradition. Secondly, he did have and oversaw quite brilliantly a new generation of economists concerned with distributional justice who learned the lessons of the 1920s that Labour need to have a proper economic strategy. Brilliant generation of Hugh Gaitskell, Harold Wilson, you know, Evan Durbin, and a number of others who rose to prominence, brilliant young economists under the tutelage of Hugh Dalton, who transformed Labour's economic approach, the distributional utilitarian tradition, if you want. So that was locked in, as well as the early socialist ethical traditions. And thirdly, which is often under-acknowledged, is Attlee very much learned from Roosevelt and the New Deal in the 30s in America in the way they confronted fascism there, but the wider development of New Deal politics across the globe in terms of the evolution of human rights. And he quite specifically saw the development of the welfare state as a way of consolidating some of this approach to human rights, questions of liberty and freedom into the development of Labour's post-1945 strategy. And there is a continuity there because in the 30s, Attlee himself had been a key figure in the inaugural meeting of the National Council of Civil Liberty. So there's a continuity in terms of the traditions of liberty and justice. And I think rather than just being this somewhat pale, insignificant manager of these great big figures within his cabinet, Attlee combined these three traditions in quite a unique way, the first time in Labour history, and showed what a potent political project you could build if you unite these traditions. It's not a question of picking and choosing them. It's a question of creating that pluralist internal democracy and forms of leadership that can cohere these within an overall political strategy of national renewal. And that's exactly what I think Attlee brought to the table, which is a bit of a rereading or a different interpretation of his role. But I think you can back it up in terms of his diaries, his unwritten work, his some of his speeches and contributions, and especially the early history of Attlee in the East End and the ILP, and his links with probably the great proponent of ethical socialism, George Lansbury, in East London politics from actually right from the beginning. I mean, literally, Attlee was living at one end of Mile End Road and George Lansbury was living at 39 Bow Road at the other end. So, and that there was very little distance between them. So the politics of East London is absolutely critical in the way these different traditions were united.
And something that I find fascinating as well, moving on to that period in the 50s and then going into the 60s when Labour was out of power and then came back into power under Harold Wilson, is the Labour Party's relationship with science and technology, particularly the sort of seemingly scientific and technological or purported scientific and technological achievements of the Soviet Union at the time. How do you view that relationship in terms of the way that the Labour Party at the time viewed the Soviet Union? And do you think that it's interesting when comparing the kind of views of communism, the Red Scare in the United States, and comparing them to the United Kingdom, that we didn't have a similar Red Scare in the UK?
Yeah, on the contrary. I mean, Wilson was hugely impressed with the notion of state planning, five-year planning, and the technological overhaul of Soviet Union and some of the deployment of Taylorist technologies, if you want, and the forces of capitalist production, which I would to the development overall well-being of the Soviet people in terms of the development of Marxist-Leninist approaches to reordering society. And you can see, and there are continuities there with a lot of the politics of the 20s and 30s in the Labour Party, and actually earlier, right from 1917, and the approach to, you know, there was a major day conference immediately after the Soviet Revolution back in 1917, where Ramsay MacDonald was one of the speakers in favour of the revolution, or the rejection of Tsarism, actually. And obviously the Red Scare politics after 1924, the so-called Campbell case finished the nine-month first Labour government. It was followed by the Zinoviev letter. Mm-hmm. Even though the 1924 Labour government is not seen as heralding any major changes apart from housing, maybe foreign policy, what it did is succeed in precisely the way MacDonald wanted and demonstrate that Labour could govern when the press were obsessed with the Bolshevik domestic threats. And I think we can barely appreciate the scale of that turbulence, you know, at the time, including the king, who was a cousin of the Tsar. So, and you see that through the Socialist League in the 30s, some of the debates around a wider political front to resist fascism, some of the ways that the Socialist League was eventually disbanded or thrown out of the party. So this uncomfortable, slightly schizophrenic relationship with the Soviet Union and the wider communism. But one thing can be sure that Wilson himself was an admirer of that sort of state economic strategy deployed from within the Soviet Union, and he visited regularly. Some implied later that he was a spy. But, you know, there were wider sort of political spin-offs of that admiration. But I think he was a trained economist. His view was, you could harness technological change in terms of quite a utilitarian approach to economic change and material justice, which is funny because the present Labour opposition is very much trying to remodel their own domestic economic strategy and search for growth in a similar ways to Harold Wilson in the early 60s. And the National Plan was arguably the most sophisticated strategy to re-engineer and contest the comparative economic decline of the country and its comparative productivity shortfalls, which has a real resonance today through challenging the role of the Treasury, rebuilding an industrial strategy. Now, it didn't last very long, and it was historically been judged a failure. But, it is time to revisit that Wilson period, because even though history has judged it negatively, you could argue is asking all the right questions, questions that reappear regularly and, are upstream of some of the terrible economic circumstances we find ourselves in today in terms of enduring productivity problems, manufacturing problems, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a long way of answering your question. But that question of, Labour's relationship with the idea of central economic planning and the growth strategies deployed in the East is a really interesting way of looking at the Wilson period, even though I should add the Wilson government is remembered less for its growth strategy, which has tended to be seen as a failure, that it barely lasted a year, really, I suppose, the National Plan, and more for its question of civil liberties and equalities and questions of freedom and justice rather than economics. So despite the fact that Wilson himself was somewhat more of a utilitarian than a libertarian, should we say, his government embarked on some pioneering reforms of public life in ways that focused on enhancing human freedom in ways that have endured to today.
Do you think then, because as you point out, Wilson himself was more of a utilitarian, but many of the great achievements were not of a utilitarian bent, do you think that this demonstrates how viewing history simply through the lens of key individuals, leaders, right, can be a bit of a misnomer, and that it minimises the impact of an entire cabinet on changing history?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. Well, and that's what I've tried to sort of suggest in the book, is to say, look, we've been missing something through all of this, and this question of justice allows for a rerouting of history. Rather than see, I love these biographies. I mean, my colleague Thomas Simmons has written some great biographies, as has Ken Morgan, John Shepherd, I love it, and John Buell in terms of Ann Lee. They're fantastic, brilliantly colourful stories, incredible figures. And I don't mean to diminish the significance of that, but I tend to think that it considers history through the prism of these individuals, whereas more often than not, they've been victim of wider forces, and they themselves are carriers of deeper traditions of thought. That's not to say that they're running around talking about Locke and Bentham, but they are embedded with some of these ideas. They might not know it, but these ideas are arguably the powerful things that influence politics behind the backs of the actual drama. So my thing was to try and say, well, how might we inspect some of that stuff and try and unpack it? Because there's very little history about the history of political thought within Labour, which I find is really odd. Henry Drucker wrote a good book on this. Jeffrey Fook wrote a really good book on it, but there's not that many. And my attempt was to try and have a go at it through this question of what is a just society, that is influenced, albeit more often than not they don't realise it, but has influenced all Labour politicians. All Labour politicians come from or are situated within these different deeper traditions, arguably apart from Keir Starmer, which is a very interesting question because he's come to politics so late and he hasn't got, you know, every political leader rises through their party, right? Usually, they're usually a product of factions or traditions of thought or organizations. They've written books and they've situated themselves within liberal progressive traditions or utilitarian traditions or these factions or ethical traditions, apart from Keir Starmer, which is a really interesting question to me about why that is and what the consequences of that. But usually, I think it's a good way of rerouting your way through Labour's story, which is dramatic, turbulent, and extraordinarily difficult to navigate because of the highs and lows. We've been in power 33 years out of 100. Only three of our 23 leaders have won general elections, majorities of general elections. It's a story of immense highs, you know, welfare state, socialised medicine, pioneering equalities legislation, but terrible defeats, factional intolerance, wretched internal cultures, big collisions with the electorate. And how do you account for the highs and lows in that? And I think biography doesn't really get you there.
Yeah.
But this question of how these different traditions bend through the Labour story is a good, I think it is, I think it's a good way of, you know, resetting that conversation.
Yeah. And in terms of the various factions, which you mentioned there, and the fact that factions often colour the way that so many people view Labour history, how much do you think the attraction of people to particular factions is often down to philosophical agreement, and how much of it do you think is down to the fact that there are particular personalities situated within those factions that draw people into them?
Right. Well, let me give you an example. I've never met that many combatants on the far left who are that aware of Marxism, who know that much about it, really, to be honest with you. And similarly, I don't meet many advocates of revisionism who are that clued up on Bernstein and the history of social democracy. You know what I mean? So even though they self-identify as factional combatants, more often than not, they pick teams, right, or individuals, and they're not fully, you know, conversant of the intellectual traditions that define these factions. So it becomes highly personalized and quite simplified. And therefore, the myth-making can kick in, you know? And that sort of, the building this canyon down the middle of the party becomes easy between left and right, and that's how we understand it. Our guys, their guys. Whereas, to be put it bluntly, an awful lot of the hard left and the hard right and the Labour are exactly the same, right? They are very similar in terms of their method, their sort of utilitarian approach to what constitutes justice, their centralised command and control approach to state capture, you know, to deliver socialist change, their views of party domination and factional contest, and they have a very similar views. They're sort of the equivalence in terms of their approach to how they understand the history. You know, it's sort of, it comes from they invert history, but it's very similar ways of looking at it, which I always find funny. Their lack of interest in the intellectual wiring of their traditions and their similarities between the two. And that sort of rips complexity from Labour's story, which means that you can't really own the victories and the defeats. And I think that accounts for some of the dreadful losses because of the internal culture that is informed by this. So therefore, can you reclaim other exile traditions and ways of looking at it that might allow for a more pluralist, inclusive culture and approach to governance as well?
And one of the things that I find interesting is, as you mentioned, you know, various Labour histories, is that sometimes, particularly from those Labour historians on the left, you get an interpretation of revisionism and in particular New Labour as sitting outside the tradition of the Labour Party. And do you think that that's merely a case of an unwillingness to accept that revisionism exists within the traditions of the Labour Party? Or do you think that it's a case that maybe that there is some point that New Labour itself, hence the new in the title, is distinctly different from what came before?
Well, I would see, I would argue, what's usually seen is that revisionism is a method on the Labour right to create a more contemporary Labour politics. So, my view is that there's a left and a right revisionism within the history of Labour, right? There's waves of different types of revisionism. And they're both vital in terms of ensuring that Labour remains an agile, contemporary political project. So I would see Bennism as including some revisionist elements inherited from the new left revisionism of the post-war era, which was a recoiling against the utilitarian, authoritarian traditions of orthodox Marxism and Stalinism. And so the new left is a key revisionist force outside of, but one foot in, one foot out of Labour, right? Similarly, the 50s revisionism of Crossland and some of the ethical revisionism of the period. There's different shades of revisionism on the left and the right of the Labour Party. And so we need a much more complicated story. So new Labour can be seen as a way of harnessing these two different types of left and right-wing revisionism within Labour that pulled it together. And similarly, the post-war Attlee government was of a similar character. And I would see it as a way of uniting these traditions of justice and the way that they are revisionism at its best across the Labour Party is methods of refreshing Labour with recourse to these different traditions of justice. So revisionism is not the sole preserve of one faction or factional tradition. It's a vital component of a reimagined Labour politics for the modern day, and that is a drumbeat through history. So the revisionism, the economic revisionism of the 30s was vital, as well as the 50s, the post-war approach to human rights. These are all elements of revisionist thinking, and they're absolutely vital to ensure that Labour isn't just an instrumental, stable political project beholden to factional advantage. So it's uncomfortable at its best. Revisionism is uncomfortable and challenging. And that's true very much of parts of the Bennist tradition, parts of the New Left, which informed elements of New Labour as much as the 50s and the modernising of the 80s, etc. So it's a vital life force within a political party and its evolution.
And you mentioned Keir Starmer earlier, and obviously you touched upon him in the book. I just wondered, in terms of the comparison between him and Ramsay MacDonald, both of them are on the cover of the book. How do you feel that they compare in terms of their place within the Labour Party and in terms of the way that they interact with the sort of the broader traditions of the Labour Party?
That's a really good question. I mean, well, the differences are obvious, and in the sense of Ramsay MacDonald's history in the party as an ideologist, as an organiser. Keir Starmer doesn't have that back history. He has a very different back history, but both share a desire for moderation, which I find really interesting, because that tension between moderation and radicalism lies at the heart of Labour history. It was ever present, even at the rally to celebrate the successful 1923 election in weeks before the actual first Labour minority government. Literally, Ramsay MacDonald is preaching the virtue of moderation to a mass party that resembled a religious movement in its desire for a new socialist commonwealth. And that tension is ever present. There's tension there that's acute today, where we've got a country almost disintegrating and the desire for radical change, but at the same time, the leadership's search for and preaching of moderation. And it's totally understandable, because it's very difficult for Labour to win. So there's only narrow paths to victory. And so you can understand the desire to preach moderation and reassurance. But the real danger for me is, What does that mean in terms of a mandate to change? Ramsay MacDonald jettisoned the wealth tax, right, in 1924, the nationalisation programs, the public works programs, Keir Starmer, because he hasn't had that historical association with different traditions and factions in Labour, can move very quickly between different groups. He's not attached to or bound to different traditions. So he's moved very quickly since when he got elected and the agenda he got elected on. We'll see how that plays out, though, because, you know, whilst it means that he's very agile, it means there's a sort of elusive quality to him in terms of where does he fit within this history, which is used to great purpose. But, you know, there's also this recurring theme of, well, what is the agenda beyond preaching the virtues of moderation, especially in a country disfigured by housing crisis, cost of living crisis, the ecological challenges, you know, the epochal changes in new technologies, you know, the rise of authoritarian populism across the globe. Where will Labour situate in all of these things? And what would be the agenda? That, you know, we are yet to fully see what that is beyond the message and language of moderation and reassurance.
Indeed. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, John. It's been great to speak to you, but I do have one final question. This book obviously details the first 100 years of the Labour Party, but if you were to journey into the future, if you were to go 100 years into the future, where do you hope the Labour Party would be, and where do you think the Labour Party will be?
Well, I mean, it touches on the question we were talking about earlier about the origins question and the death question. I see the Labour Party as an agile institution that has, through different forms of revisionism, has demonstrated a capacity to reinvention and is not captured with backward-looking false ideologies or factions. So there is this inherent creativity within it that's driven because of these competing visions of justice. Now, given, it seems to me, call me naive, but given the environmental challenges that, you know, question the, and the technological challenges that question the, you know, that challenge the integrity of the human being, this seems to me to create fertile ground for a new humanist Labour politics, ethical politics, as well as does the patterns of wealth and inequality that will allow for, you know, new forms of economic and social rights that build on these traditions of freedom and human rights within Labour history, and aligned with, you know, if we can provide new compelling visions of distributive justice, whereby it's, capital is allowed to freelance, has sort of surfed the last decades with little accountability in terms of its contribution. Meanwhile, the tax take on average workers is increasing all the while because it's not fairly distributed. So the question of taxing not just income but wealth allows for a new vision of distributional justice. So these three traditions seem to me are highly contemporary in terms of their usefulness, in terms of navigating the modern world and providing and cohering around a new vision of politics and the country. So it seems to me if we can have a leadership that can harness all three, the future is very bright. But it's going to be very bumpy. Get there, because, you know, the three parties, or the traditional social democracy, has lost its moral component. Really. The post-war model wanted to civilize capitalism, you know, attack the market. It lost a lot of its potency in the Blair, Schroeder, Clinton era, and it's lost its moral potency. That's arguably what Corbyn brought for a while. Labour needs to discover that ethical tradition. And also it needs to discover its radicalism around distributional justice, around patterns of wealth, and also rediscover its liberalism. Even though liberalism is changing all the time, I think it needs to discover a real new approach to questions of liberty in defense of the human condition given these technological challenges. So I'm quite optimistic, but it's going to be, I'm optimistic. Well, I'm hopeful, not optimistic. Should we say that?
Perhaps the best way to be hopeful. Well, thank you once again for taking the time to speak to me, John. If people want to buy the book, where should they go to purchase a copy?
They can get it anywhere and get them. Guardian Bookshop, Policy Bookshop, any Waterstones, you know, get it anywhere.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Will, for having us again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.